Today's Teisho will be on case 83 in the Heikigan Roku, the Pien Lu, the Lu Rock Collection. Case 83 is entitled Umon's The Old Buddha Communes with the Pillar. Main subject: Umon spoke to his disciples and said, "The old Buddha communes with the pillar. What level of spiritual activity would this be?" And he himself gave the answer for them, saying, "Clouds gather over the southern hill, rain falls on the northern mountain." Secho's verse, "Rain on the northern mountain, clouds over the southern hill, 4 7s and 2 3s, I see them face to face. In Korea, they assemble in the lecture hall. In China, they have not beaten the drum or rung the bell. Joy in the midst of pain, pain in the midst of joy. Who dares to say gold is the same as soil?" It's day three of our session, and now we're getting somewhere. Now we're getting somewhere. It's really wonderful, wonderful to see. You know, it takes a while, but takes a few days. Takes 3 days, generally speaking, and everything changes. You know, we live in a society like a mass distraction, right? Mass distraction, and it's become the case that people actually make money off of distracting other people. You know, so I myself am not criticizing anybody who owns a phone. But I myself don't own a phone because they're so highly addictive. And my students come into class on the first day of class, and I come in, and they're all, in the old days, people would, I know old men used to all the time say, "In the old days." I understand. But in the old days, you know, I can remember going into classrooms and sitting next to people, and before the teacher came in, doing what we used to call shooting the bull, right? Mm-hmm. You weren't shooting a bull, but you were bullshitting. We said bullshit. So you say, "Hey, you know," or killing time. You say, "But did I see you in that philosophy course? And what are you majoring in?" And you know, just talking. You know, just talking. And you know, you'd get to know people in the class, and then the teacher would come in, and everybody would get quiet. And then afterwards, you know, you'd all go out, and maybe you'd say, "Hey, listen, you know, want to get a cup of coffee? Or, you know, do you play basketball? Do you want to play?" You know, I come into my class, and everybody's texting. And I'll say, "Okay, put your phones away," and they put them on the table. But I say, "No, away." Right, and it's like with trembling hands they put them, and you know, a lot of them are on. They're looking at Twitter, or they're Instagramming, or they're checking their news feeds. And my wife has a phone, and I'll come into the room, and she's she's on the phone. It's like, "Hello." You know, and she's on the phone, you know, or she's doing something. She's looking at her news feeds, and I'll be sitting there. We'll be in the living room reading, and all of a sudden I'll hear this, like television going on her phone, right? You know, and so she's playing a movie or something on her phone. It's definitely the case that people want you to be enthralled, right? And I myself go online. I have a computer, and I read things online. And you know, we often have a conversation like this. I'll say, you know, I saw something today that was fascinating, and I wanted to share it with you, but I can't remember what it is. You know, and she said, oh, that's funny, because I had something I wanted to share with you, but what was it? You know, because it was like then and that was replaced by other ideas, right? And so people have a vested interest in getting other people to consume information. And it's so different from the way it used to be. I mean, I can remember in my grandparents' time, you know, getting a letter from somebody was like a major event, right? So, you know, I remember being at my father's parents lived in Newark, and we went up to visit them. And you know, we were sitting in the living room, and my grandmother said, you know, we got a letter from Claire. It was like, oh, you know, everybody paid attention, and my grandmother read the letter from Claire, right, you know. And it, because they had, you know, even telephones were actually relative, not everybody had a phone, you know. So getting a letter from Claire was really something, very different, you know. So people had a different pace in their lives, you know. Information wasn't something that was as all-consuming as it is now. And we definitely get addicted to information. You know, we're definitely addicted to it. You know, so you know, I think if my students had been in the living room with my grandparents, they would have jumped out the window. They would have been so bored, right? Because there's not this. People are sitting there. Do you want a cup of coffee? Yes, and. You know, after reading Claire's letter, everybody would sort of ruminate on Claire's letter and say, well, you know, that's how's Benny doing, you know? And then they talk about, well, we haven't heard from him. The last letter we got from him was like in November, right? You know, and he seems to be doing okay, you know? So, you know, different world. I definitely think my students are addicted, and I myself crave information, you know. So when I, at lunch, you know, at lunchtime, people will leave my office and I have put my tasks aside, whatever it might be, and then I just start, you know, eating junk food on the internet, right? And I'll go to Salon and I'll look at an article, and then I'll go to, you know, Huffington Post, and then I will go to something else, and I think, uh-oh, I better eat something because, you know, I'm using up my lunch time on the computer. So I'll go out and get something to eat and come back, you know, and it's definitely, you sort of like craving, right, craving information. So it's really wonderful that we come here and we, you know, hopefully turn our phones off. You know, I hope you're not on your phone in the break period. It would be, again, if you have to be, I understand, you know, but it would be ideally the best thing in the world if you just put a message on your email and your other outlets and just said, I will be out of contact for, you know, the next 4 days. And if you can do that, it would be very liberating for you. But it's probably hard for you to do that. It's not just that people are trying to reach you, but we definitely are addicted to that kind of stimulus. And I think part of it is, you know, we don't know how to be empty-headed. Empty-headed. There was a famous event that I've talked about before, but I just think it's so interesting. Around the turn of the 19th century, the end of the 19th century, there was a guy in Chicago named Paul Karras, and he was an academic, and he had this idea that basically all the world's religions should get together and exchange ideas. And he was sort of a Unitarian inspired thinker, and he organized a conference, and he had people from all the different religions coming to Chicago, and it was the first World Parliament of Religions. That was what it was called. And anyway, you know, they had Sikhs and Sufis. And of course, Catholic and Protestant, various Jewish traditions were represented, you know, Islam, Sunni people were there, and I assume Shia people were there. Apparently, there was a Hindu philosopher who made a big, I don't think it was Krishnamurti, but it might have been, I don't think it was, but it was a Hindu philosopher. He was like toward the end of the program, and he gave this fascinating speech, and he was talking about rebirth and levels of reality, and the audience, you know, were sort of a broad-minded, liberal Americans. They were interested in ideas, they were interested in, you know, other ways of seeing, and they really were fascinated by this. And then it was the time for a Japanese Zen priest named Soyen Shaku. He was D.T. Suzuki's teacher. Soyen Shaku got up and he said, you know, the problem with the modern world is that people don't know how to be dumbfounded. And everybody burst into laughter. They thought it was a translation mistake, right? Because, you know, they were expecting like a seven-course meal of ideas. And, you know, the Hindu speaker was a brilliant guy, and you know, it was like one amazing insight after another. People were writing it all down, you know, people, you know, like scratching their chins like that. You know, can consciousness exist without the body? You know, that's really something. Are there planes of existence? You know, I myself, you know, I love that stuff too. You know, you know, when Soyen Shaku said, people don't know how to be dumbfounded, they literally had no idea what he was talking about. You know, I mentioned a little earlier in the session that Soyen Shaku's student, D.T. Suzuki, was given the Dharma name Blockhead. Because Suzuki knew how to be dumbfounded, you know. I think people used to know how to be dumbfounded, but they have forgotten how to be dumbfounded. And I think being dumbfounded is the door to reality, is the door to liberation. So I'm with Soyen Shaku on this one. You know, when we're you know, ideas are a funny thing. You know, a few years ago, I and my wife, who we've been married for 40 years, and we were having a period in our relationship where we were not doing well. And it was like a crisis in our relationship. And my father-in-law was living with us, and he was dying, and we were taking care of my father-in-law, and created a lot of stresses on our relationship and brought out a lot of sort of unhappiness in our relationship. So we went to a couples therapist, and it was so revealing, you know, because the couples therapist was constantly pointing out how we were intellectualizing, right? You know, so intellectualizing is something like this where, you know, maybe you feel unloved by your partner, but when the therapist says, well, what do you see as the problem? You know, one of the people in the couple will say, well, I just think we have incompatible worldviews. You know, I'm a realist and he's a dreamer, right? And, you know, if you're a therapist, you see people doing that all the time. In other words, there's like a kernel in there of feeling that is difficult and painful. And so the people involved have like secreted ideas to hide or protect themselves from this thing that's so painful, see. So you know, I studied with a teacher who once said, humans secrete ideas the way oysters secrete a shell, you know, to protect themselves. But then what they wind up doing is closing themselves off from the world. And I definitely think people do that. You know, going to this couples therapist reminded me, you know, of this, reminded me of this, you know, that I do it, you know, in my relationship with my wife, I did the same thing, you know. So, you know, instead of saying, I basically don't think my wife loves me, or I don't think she likes who I really am, you know, a person could say, well, I think we have incompatible worldviews. You know, she's a Democrat and I'm a socialist, or something like, she's a liberal and I'm a socialist, you know, those liberals, you know. And the therapist kept saying, you know, he'd say, you're intellectualizing. How do you feel? And it was very difficult to get at how we felt. You know, when he would ask us, how do you feel? You look and feel nothing, of course, because, you know, you've secreted all these layers of ideas to hide your feelings, see? So you feel nothing. I don't feel anything. And that's how people become emotionally dead and unresponsive to others, right? Then when, you know, two people have secreted all these layers hiding what they feel, they can't be honest with each other because they are not even honest with themselves. You know, so it was really beneficial in so many ways. It was wonderful. But it reminded me, I mean, you know, we don't get this particular set of skills from Zen training, actually, or I didn't. But I realized afterward, you know, this is very much like Zen training. You know, we intellectualize all the time. And so, you know, when we're, say, doing koan practice, you know, somebody gives you a koan. If you have a staff, I will give you one. If you have no staff, I will take it away. You know, and the normal response, almost anybody's response to this, is to think about it as a kind of intellectual question. You know, so if I have a staff, I'll give you. If you have a staff, he'll give me one. And if I have no staff, he'll take it away. And then you could say, well, don't you see, this is all about, you know, this or that. You come up with a theory, right? But, you know, if you sit with the koan for a while, you begin to realize, you know, something comes up that's right from your heart mind, something in your heart mind. You know, earlier I was talking about the heart mind. You know, we live in a world where it's mind, right? Just mind. We approach problems with mind. But heart mind isn't just heart. It's also mind. There's an intelligence to this, emotional intelligence, right? And there's a dharmic intelligence too, right? Which is not book learning, but it's something else. So you know, I think with the therapy that we went through, we had to learn how to be dumbfounded, right? So, you know, if somebody says, what is it you don't like about your partner? And you say, well, she's a liberal and I'm a socialist. You know, that's hiding all kinds of things, right? And then if the therapist says to you, well, what are you feeling? It's nothing, right? And so you just have to sort of sit there with that numbness or that nothingness, that not Buddhist nothingness, but nothing's coming up, right? And there's a part of our minds that wants to fill that space with something, you know, mostly more interpretation. You know, I'm a English teacher, and, you know, I have learned not to always fill in the spaces. So sometimes I'll ask my students a question. And, you know, when I first started teaching, I would ask my students a question, and if they didn't answer right away, I'd fill in the space. So I'd say, you know, if I were teaching, I once taught an essay by a writer named D.H. Lawrence, and if I said, so what is going to New Mexico mean for D.H. Lawrence? You know, if I didn't get anything in like 3 seconds, I'd start talking, well, it could mean this, you know. And I didn't give my students enough time to be dumbfounded. Because, you know, they had to not know before they could know. And so, you know, basically, if I had just let that question sit there for a while, you know, it would be a little bit like a koan. They would sort of fall, you know, actually they would fall into like stupidity almost, like dumbness, right? When you ask a real question that people aren't prepared for, they don't know what to say. And that's such a good condition, right? Now something can be learned, right? I don't know. And that's a wonderful, wonderful situation, right? I was afraid of that empty space myself. And as soon as I didn't get a response, I'd rush in and fill it up. But I wasn't letting my students be dumbfounded. And now, you know, it takes some work because, you know, you ask a question and there's a silence and people are waiting. You say, well, come on, help me out here. Just say whatever. Say something off the top of your head. I might say, what are you feeling right now? What are you feeling? And somebody will say, this is making me nervous. It's like, oh, good, what's, you know. It's definitely the case that we live in a society that has not given us appreciation for being dumbfounded. And we've been taught how to fill in all the spaces with ideas. Especially, you know, beginners in Zen do this, you know. You give somebody a koan and they'll come back and they'll say, well, you know, basically, I think the moral of the story is that you should be a good person and not be selfish, right? And it's like, well, you're not really letting yourself be dumbfounded. So when somebody comes into the Dokusan, it comes into Dokusan and says, I have no idea what this koan is. It's like wonderful, wonderful, right? That's now something can happen. So, you know, when the therapist says, how do you feel? And you realize, I don't really know how I feel. I've been living with somebody for 35 years and I don't know how. I haven't allowed myself to find out how I feel about that person. You know, that's pretty amazing, right? But we all do that. You know, so a lot of Zen practice is going to that place where we no longer know and letting things come up. And so, you know, if you have a staff, I will give you one. If you have no staff, I will take it away. And you sit with that and you come up with a theory about, you know, social inequality or something, or, you know, injustice, the injustice, Trump is president, you know, etc. You know, the ones who need help never get help, the ones who have it all don't care, you know. And then you begin to sit with that, and it resonates on a deeper level. It resonates it's like these koans are like unconscious or subconscious cues, right? It's like throwing a magic stone into a well, and it goes down, down, down through the water, and then the water begins to bubble, right? And something comes up. And you don't know what's going to come up, right? You don't know, because you don't know what you don't. You have to allow yourself to see, you know? Generally, what we have to allow ourselves to see is some of the sources of our suffering and also some of the solutions to our suffering. So, you know, Zen practice is, you know, the way we do Zen practice with these koans is being willing to let the koan guide us, right? It's like internalizing a subconscious cue and letting it take us where it's going to take us, and we don't know where, right? And that means for some period, maybe a day or two, or it could be months, right? Just not knowing. You know, I definitely had koans where I would go to sesshin, and I had the same koan at the end. You know, everybody would be leaving sesshin, and you're not supposed to talk about your koans with other people. You really shouldn't. What we say in Dokusan is confidential, and you shouldn't share it with other people. But, you know, in our Zen center in Seattle, you know, people would all drive home together. I would drive home, and people would be in the car. I remember people would be saying, "Oh, yeah, I passed my koan. Which one?" You know, and then what was your answer? You know, and then, and I once stole somebody's answer. How embarrassing! He gave it to the teacher. But you know, I would sit in the car and, you know, be very quiet. Everybody go, "Oh yeah, I passed my koan." Now I wouldn't say a word because I didn't pass my koan. You know, I listened. Yeah. You know, he gave me a new one, you know. I said, how wonderful that must be, you know, to get a new koan. Because I was stuck with, there are a number of occasions where I was stuck with one koan for a long time. I remember Genki Roshi said that the most number of koans I ever answered in one sesshin was like 12 or something. It's like, well, let's see now. I'm doing one a year. I might be passing one a year. Okay. So the thing is, there was something I really didn't want to see, but also I just didn't know how to be dumbfounded. You know, even when I was working with the Mu koan, you know, I kept trying to come up with an intellectual answer. And I wrote poetry to my teacher. I would go into the, you know, he said, actually it wasn't the Mu koan, pardon me, it was breath perception. I was working with breath perception, and I was a part of a contingent. Genki Roshi came in 1976, I think. There were all these young people in Seattle who were interested in Buddhism, and they became a student, and we all went to sesshin together, and he started us all with breath perception. And breath is a koan too, right? We think we know what the breath is. The breath goes in and the breath goes out. But actually, you know, if you allow yourself to be dumbfounded, the breath does strange things. You know, actually the breath is like your teacher. You let the breath take you where it will. So, you know, I didn't know how to be dumbfounded. You know, I knew how to be dumbfounded if I went hiking, right? You know, I'd like to go hiking and I would go up into the mountains and be dumbfounded, right? But when it was time to do koan training, I thought my job was to produce insight, right? So I would go into the teacher and I would say, you know, I read these poems, these beautiful poems. I brought flowers to my teacher. And sometimes, by the way, flowers would be a good answer to the koan, but not in this case. I brought him a sandwich. I brought him, you know, different things. And all I had to do was just watch the breath and be dumbfounded. But it was so hard for me, right? And so, you know, I went through this period where I wasn't answering my koans. And answering the koan isn't the most important thing. You know, the most important thing is encountering our true nature. So even if it takes 10 years, that's okay. You know, there's really not a timetable, right? In the Korean, some Koreans and traditions, they just give you one koan all your life. And you can even go back to a koan after many years and it's a completely new experience. So it's not about racking up the koans, right? So being dumbfounded is really the essence of Zen. And it's very difficult for people to be dumbfounded because it means you're giving up control. It means, you know, and that's why my students like to text, right? Because, you know, coming into a strange classroom and meeting people you don't know is a difficult, you get used to it, but it's a difficult experience. You know, going to college is a big deal. Right? You've lived in some little place in New Jersey, you know, all your life, all your town in New Jersey, and now you're leaving home and you're going to your college far from home, and you're with all these strangers, right? And that's actually, that's one of the most wrenching things people will do in their lives. After college, you get used to it, right? Then you get a job and you get shipped to California, right? And you're used to it because college taught you how to do that. But it's nerve-wracking to be in a room with strangers and be far from home and know nobody. So they go onto the phone, and that gives them a kind of control. But it would be better if they put their phones in the purse or in their backpack, and just sat and, you know, try to encounter somebody else in the room. So Zen practice is about being dumbfounded, and this koan is actually about being dumbfounded. Umon is really one of the great Zen teachers. His name means cloud gate, Yunmen. Yunmen, Japanese is Umon. Umon came into his disciples. He comes into the Dokus, into the Zendo, and he says, "The old Buddha communes with the pillar. What level of spiritual activity would that be?" And then nobody answers. So he does what I just said a good teacher doesn't do. He answered it himself. But it's also a kind of koan. And he gave the answer saying, "Clouds gather over the southern hills, rain falls on the northern mountain." So he's saying, if you know how to be dumbfounded, you'll be able to figure this out. What does it mean, the old Buddha communes with the pillar? Well, you know, when you're in your mental world, you know, when you're caught up in your thoughts and so on and so on, you're not dumbfounded. Every time something happens, you're secreting ideas, right? And unfortunately, you know, we identify with our ideas. You know, so we identify with the ideas that are moving through our heads, and we say, "This is me. I'm what's happening in my head." And those ideas trigger emotions, right? They trigger emotions. So, you know, we all tend to have something like familiar, it's like we all have in our wallets a driver's license, a couple credit cards, if you're in the state health system, you have your medical card, you know, and we all have stuff like that in our wallets. We all have like ideas that tend to be like familiar ideas, sort of mental routines we go through over and over again. And those we identify with, right? But around day three of Sesshin, something happens, right? You're watching the breath, and instead of just watching your thoughts, you know, for day one of Sesshin, it's like thought, and you're trying to get to the breath. And, you know, and the thoughts catch you, and then you go with them, you know, so you have a thought, and then you realize, oh, yeah, I wonder if he's going to like that report. And then you start thinking, I wonder if he liked the last one. Pretty soon, 25 minutes have gone, right? And you've embraced those thoughts, and you've treated it as who you are, and it's enclosed you, and you might not notice anything around you. You know, you might not notice anybody in the room, you might not notice anything, the sound of the crickets. It's just, you're totally gripped. That's sort of day one. And on day two, you know, you're getting a little tired, and the thoughts are starting to break up. They're not so coherent anymore, right? But, you know, around day three, you're beginning to be dumbfounded. You're beginning to have that blockhead. So, you know, you're sitting on the cushion and you're watching your breath, and sometimes you fall back into the chains of thinking, but often it's like thought, thought, thought. See, and there's like these spaces between your thoughts, empty-headed, empty spaces. See, and this is the beginning of liberation. It's the beginning of liberation because we're not identifying with our thoughts. You know, if you think about it, very few of your thoughts are something you invented yourself, right? Thoughts are, words are like money. They go from person to person, you know. If you say, this is my dollar bill and it's nobody else's, you can't spend it. As soon as you spend it, it's gone. Well, words are just money, right? They're just money. Well, in high school, I had a class in word power. And we were really like acquiring money. It's like acquiring wealth. So then later in college, I could write, he applied himself assiduously. Right? My teacher would say, oh, very good, Mr. Spellmeyer, you know, assiduous, right? So that's like money. That's like having a nice suit coat or something, right? So other ideas, you know, are also just things we pick up, you know? We just pick them up and put them in our mental pocket. And sometimes ideas stick with us because somebody stamped them on our heads, you know. So there's so many things like this, right? When I was a boy, my father was worried because I didn't like sports, and my father grew up in the Newark area, and he tried to be tough. He tried to be a guy, you know. And so he was worried that I wasn't being enough of a guy. I didn't like football. I found it boring. I liked to play with puppets, you know. Really, you know, worried my father. I remember once, we went into the bathroom, and I sat down on the toilet to urinate. And my father got very upset. He said, a man doesn't sit on the toilet. You know, he pisses upright. Right? And years later, I was sitting on the toilet, and I was urinating. And I was filled with anxiety, right? It's like, you know, maybe I shouldn't be doing this. I should stand up, you know? That's crazy, right? But, you know, that idea is in there somewhere, right? That you don't sit down. A man stands up when he urinates, you know? So, you know, there are ideas like that, right? That have been put into our mental basket, you know, and that we carry around with us all our lives, and they have this absurd weight on our behavior, right? You know, we all have lots of those. So you know, liberation means being able to get away from those ideas, to let them go. And you can't think your way free from them, right? You have to go through 3 days of sesshin, and around day three of sesshin, you know, it begins to be the case that, you know, you have a thought, but then there's this big space, and you have another thought, and there's a space, and then there's another thought, and there's a space. And the thing is, when these spaces grow, the thoughts are less gripping. And it's like a thought enters your attention. And it may trigger, it may seem somewhat absorbing, and it may trigger an emotional response, say anxiety or sadness or something. But then it just drifts off again. So the thought comes into your field of vision, and it may be a little bit gripping, but then it trails off, and then another thought. And then another thought. You know, and after a while, they stop gripping you so much, right? And when the thoughts begin to become less frequent, and the empty spaces become more frequent, you're entering that block-headed state. You're communing with the pillar, see? And in that state, you know, basically, you may find, you know, suddenly something bubbles up, you know, that is very powerfully important, you know, that you didn't want to see, or you wanted to see, but you didn't know you wanted to see. Or, you know, sometimes when you're in that empty-headed state, you suddenly hear the birds singing outside and you become one with the birds, right? Which doesn't happen when you're caught up in your mental movies, right? So the door to liberation is that emptiness. It starts out as spaces between your thoughts. And it generally takes people a good 3 days to begin to commune with the pillar, right? To really commune with the pillar. You know, on day three of sesshin, you get up and you come in and you look at the bowl of rice and you don't even think rice. Your head is empty and your attention is 100% rice. And I think that's a deeper way to live. I think that's a different way of experiencing the world, right? And everything, very often, when you're in that empty-headed state, everything comes alive. It's like a film has been. I just got new glasses, actually, really. And I had these old glasses, old lenses on my glasses, and I knew I was making all these mistakes in my emails, and I didn't catch them. In fact, I even wrote Buddhism, and I hit the dollar sign where it should have been a D. Really, I looked back, and I was horrified, right? The proofreader caught it, you know. But, and I'm a terrible typist, too. So anyway, I got new glasses, and I'm like, wow, you know. Well, it's like that, you know, around day three, everything comes alive because there isn't this film of projection. You know, the you're not circulating the money anymore. You're seeing the world through those empty spaces between your thoughts. And this is the beginning of liberation. If you're not there yet, you know, it takes, please, in Buddhism, in Zen rather, there's three pillars. Great faith or great trust. Trust the process. Great determination. Let's face it, if you're still here, you have great determination. And the third pillar is great doubt. And great doubt doesn't mean, what the hell am I doing here? It means empty-headed, block-headed, empty, thoughtless, empty-headed, dumbfounded, great dumbfounded. Main subject, Umon spoke to his disciples and he said, the old Buddha communes with the pillar. What level of spiritual activity would that be? And he himself gave the answer for them, saying, clouds gather over the southern hill. See, when your mind is empty, you become one with. Rain falls on the northern mountain. Secho's verse, rain on the northern mountain, clouds over the southern hill. Four sevens and two threes, I see them face to face. In Korea, they assemble in the lecture hall. In China, they have not beaten the drum or rung the bell. Joy in the midst of pain, pain in the midst of joy. Who dares to say gold is the same as soil?